And our guest is Michael Cremo. His latest work is called The Forbidden Archaeologist. We're going to get into some more of the fascinating topics at hand with Michael when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We're with Michael Cremo. Michael, it does fascinate me, as we look into hidden archaeology and what they might have done, the possibilities that we went to the moon, we've been to other places. But where are most of the artifacts? Where'd they go?
Well, we have to keep in mind that our geological situation on Earth is not very favorable for preserving all artifacts of the past over long periods of time, especially the types of things that we consider to be signs of advanced technological civilization, like airplanes and computers and things like that, which are made of metal, and most metals oxidize very rapidly if they're not preserved in an anaerobic environment. That means an environment without any oxygen in it. And also, plastics and things of that sort, they don't preserve very long.
Glass, it's all gone, right?
That's right. There actually have been some studies, and this is related to environmental science. There have been some studies about how long our cities and everything in them would last if human beings were to disappear from the Earth today. And the experts who have studied this, including geologists and paleontologists and others, have concluded that these things wouldn't last very long. As I said, metals would oxidize. We have our concrete structures. We think they're very permanent, but the iron beams in them will eventually corrode. And as those iron beams corrode, they expand, and that means the concrete and everything will break off of them. And over many thousands of years, gradually, it would just be reduced to little piles of rust and broken bits of concrete and glass that you wouldn't really recognize as remains of a civilization unless you were very, very carefully looking. And then there's also the fact that most of our cities are located on rivers and ocean shores and lake shores, and their existence depends on dams and seawalls and levees that, without human beings around to take care of them, would break down, and that means that floodwaters would wash over these areas. We've seen just in recent history some tsunamis. There's also volcanoes, earthquakes that occur regularly around the world, and there are even larger geological processes related to huge, the continents. Continental drift, the continents themselves being taken under other continents or plates of according to plate tectonics. So over vast periods of time, a lot of the evidence will disappear. Some will be left. But particularly as we go back further and further in time, there'll be less and less evidence found. And that's what I discovered in my forbidden archaeology work. There is evidence for a very ancient human presence on this planet, but the further back you go in time, the more sparse the evidence becomes, which is what you would expect.
Okay, now, Michael, when you did the work specifically for the latest work, The Forbidden Archaeologist, did you come across anything that, others would say, that's baffling, that's stumbling, but because of your past work with forbidden archaeology and human devolution, you simply said, this is a natural occurrence. This just flows into what I've been doing.
Yes. A lot of the work that I've done in putting forbidden archaeology together did flow into the later work, the forbidden archaeologists and others. It's there is sort of a natural progression there. What I tried to add into these essays that are part of the forbidden archaeologists is more of the personal element of what it was like for me personally to be involved in this kind of research, how the different kinds of reactions that I got to the work that I'm doing, how I respond to it, things of that sort. So, yes, there is a connection between the earlier work and the later work I've been doing. But I've also tried to branch out into some new areas, as I mentioned, especially the archaeology of India and alternative theories of human origins that are consciousness-based rather than matter-based and things of that sort. But they all do relate to each other because the unifying principle in all of my research is human origins and antiquity. So anything that has to do with that, I'm interested in. And my main focus for a long time was, the archaeological evidence for extreme human antiquity, but I've also branched out into other areas as well.
Why is India not a powerhouse today? It sounds like they might have been a long time ago.
Well, there were, and according to the accounts, they had a worldwide empire. They had very advanced technologies. Now, what's happened, of course, they still are one of the largest economies in the world. They've been able to launch spacecraft and satellites. They have an advanced military. They produce a lot of their own weapons. So they do have they still do have a lot of importance in the world. They're one of the developing economies. They're a huge market for our goods. So they still do have some significance, but in the course of time, the way that history worked out is for a long time they were under foreign domination, and a lot of their wealth was transferred out of their country, which is something we're experiencing today in the United States, but they had undergone centuries of domination by foreign powers. So I think that's had some influence on them. And there's also the fact that that culture was based on a very ethical and moral system, codes of conduct and behavior that depended on what they call dharma, the right way of doing things, so that they were in harmony with nature, they were in harmony with the universe, they were in harmony with the spiritual dimensions of reality. So that gave them a lot of power. But as the cycles of time have gone on, a lot of that dharma or right way of doing things has deteriorated. Of course, not just there, but all over the world. According to these ancient Sanskrit writings, there are cycles of time. There's a cycle of four ages that repeats again and again and again. And the first age is a golden age, and the second age, things deteriorate a little bit. The third age, things deteriorate a little bit more. And finally, in the fourth age, called the Kali Yuga, the one we're in now, things get really bad. And this means that dharma, or the right way of doing and perceiving things, also deteriorates. There are predictions in the ancient Sanskrit writings about how the age of Kali will go forward. It is said that there will be increasing environmental disturbances. There will be extremes of heat, extremes of cold. Desertification will gradually increase. Deforestation will gradually increase. Extinction of animals will gradually increase. The condition of human society will become more and more difficult. It was predicted thousands of years ago that the governments would become more exploitative of their people, simply taking extreme amounts of tax money from them so that people would try to hide their wealth. They would go to the forest to get away from the extreme taxation and exploitation of the governments. And also it was predicted that biologically the human population would deteriorate. There would be increasing amounts of disease, both physical and mental, increasing amounts of conflict. So it's a pretty dark picture, and it seems to be unfolding like that if we look at the direction that human civilization has taken on. So that Indian culture was also affected by these, as have all the cultures in the world been affected by these developments in, as the age of Kali progresses.
Do you think when our astronauts got to the moon, they landed there and saw artifacts, spaceships from another time?
I think that's possible. I'm not aware that any of them have reported that. There are some studies that have been done showing that there appear to be structures on the moon. There's been some studies of what's called extraterrestrial archaeology. So I think it's possible that they may have encountered such things. Of course, it's also possible that a lot may have been concealed from them. You know, just like on our planet, we don't just allow anyone to go to our top secret military bases to see everything that's there, you know, all the weapons that are under development, all the technologies that are being used. There's security. And if, say, a strange aircraft or spacecraft were to approach the Earth, there would probably be some attempt to divert it, put it down in some unpopulated area of the country, some desert region. So it may have been the same when the Earth-based astronauts went to this planet, the moon planet. I think it's inhabited. That's the information that's given in the Vedic astronomy, that it's inhabited. Actually, all the celestial bodies are inhabited, but they may be inhabited by beings who are dealing with more subtle energies and technologies than we're used to. Just like, say, if a Western person, you know, with all advanced communications technology were to go to some primitive tribal people on this planet, the modern people would be in touch with more subtle energies and be more in control of them. So in the same way, on these other celestial bodies, I think there are entities, there are living beings who are more powerful than we are. They, just as we're able to manipulate our technologies to defend our countries and our communications and our are methods of transportation. I think the beings on these other planets and moons and other celestial bodies have their technologies and their ways of protecting themselves, of concealing themselves, of hiding what is valuable to them from us.
These ancient Sanskrits, the writings of India, what fascinated you the most about that? The ancient wars, the flying machines, what was it, Michael?
Well, for me, it was a very comprehensive picture of reality that seemed to make a lot of sense. It seemed to incorporate into it all types of evidence that are rejected by modern science, which therefore leaves modern science with an incomplete picture of reality. You know, for example, you know, these ancient Sanskrit writings spoke of mystic powers, like the remote viewing, psychokinesis, you know, mind over matter, things of that sort. And modern science has more or less rejected all of this stuff, even though there is some very good evidence for it, you know, which I've documented in some of my works like Human Devolution. You know, for example, it's not very well known, but some of our most famous scientists have engaged in research into the paranormal and concluded there are paranormal powers. For example, the physicists Marie and Pierre Curie, who were working in the early 20th century in Paris, were doing experiments with mediums, with psychokinetic powers, the ability to make large objects float in the middle of the air in laboratories. And, you know, the Curies, Pierre and Marie Curie, had Nobel Prizes in physics. They're very famous. But this part of their work is just excluded from modern science, from the physics textbooks, but it's there in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. There are these accounts of very ancient human civilizations on this planet. It's part of their picture of reality. It should be part of our picture of reality, but due to the knowledge filtering process, our modern scientific establishment rejects all of the evidence that supports these things. Also, there is evidence for reincarnation. Reincarnation is a fascinating idea that's found in these ancient Sanskrit writings of India. To me, it's always been very fascinating. It's explained a lot to me about my own personal life. So I'm not just interested in these ancient Sanskrit writings because of information they have about external reality. I'm also interested in them because they have ideas and insights that I find very helpful for understanding my own life, my own struggles with comprehending the world that I live in. And one thing that's really helped me understand my life is this idea of reincarnation.
Let's get into that too, Michael, when we come back. Fast program. The Forbidden Archaeologist, Michael Cremo, on Coast to Coast AM. Even Richard Hoagland is listening to the program tonight, all excited when he heard Michael Cremo talking about some things on the moon. Fascinating subject. We'll be back with more with Michael Cremo as we talk about The Forbidden Archaeologist on Coast to Coast AM. Michael, what keeps pushing you with these cutting-edge investigations?
Well, one thing is that I just enjoy what I'm doing, really. And another thing is I found that one thing just leads to another. When I first started doing this forbidden archaeology research, I had an idea that while there might be some archaeological evidence for extreme human antiquity, I might find a few cases and write a short article or pamphlet about this evidence and then move on to something else. But as I got into the research, which I originally thought was going to take 8 weeks, the 8 weeks turned into 8 months, and the 8 months turned into 8 years, because one case just led to another. So a kind of momentum builds up. And another thing that has kept me going and going to new levels is the response I get from readers. When I first brought out the book Forbidden Archaeology, which is 900 pages long, some readers asked, could you make a shorter version, please? So I did that. I respond to the feedback that I get from readers and people who hear me. So we came out with a shorter edition of that book called The Hidden History of the Human Race. And then people started asking me, well, what's the scientific reaction to your work? So that motivated me to put together a book called Forbidden Archaeology's Impact, where I put together all the reactions from the scientific world to my work, both positive and negative. And then people started asking me, okay, you've got all this evidence that contradicts the current theories of human origins. Well, where do you think human beings came from? So that motivated me to write the book Human Devolution, where I presented my ideas, alternative ideas about human origins. So that's been a big factor in motivating me and keeping me going, is the synergy that exists between me and my readers. It's something that really does motivate me and keep me going. And another thing that keeps me going is the understanding that I've come to that the topics that I'm dealing with are very important for everyone, really. In one sense, you could say, well, what difference does it make whether human beings have been here a few thousand or a few million years? I mean, isn't this just some abstract topic for a few scientists? Or
no, I want to know what happened to them.
Yeah, so that's what I mean. You know, yeah. I'm constantly getting feedback and queries and questions, and it does motivate me to go on, because I can see that it's really a key issue, because the goals that we set for ourselves individually and collectively to a large extent depend on our sense of identity. And today, through the monopoly they have in the education system, the supporters of the current theories of human origins have had the ability to dictate to us our sense of identity. And this sense of identity that they're giving is very materialistic. Yeah, they're saying, well, you're just a chemical machine, that's what you are. And you're not only just a chemical machine, but you're a chemical machine in competition with other chemical machines for survival. And I think this sense of identity that's being forced on people through the scientists who have a government-enforced monopoly in the education system is to a large extent responsible for a lot of the problems that we're facing in the world today. We have an environmental crisis. Why do we have an environmental crisis? It's because we're identifying ourselves as purely material beings with purely material needs, and therefore we think that the main purpose of human existence is to produce and consume more and more material things, and we're doing that, and we're poisoning the air, poisoning the land, poisoning the water. And as this mentality spreads throughout the world and we bring in hundreds of more people in China and India to try to produce and consume at the same level that we are in America and Western Europe, it's just not sustainable. You know, the Earth really can't sustain that. And I think this false sense of identity that's been forced on us is also responsible for a lot of the financial crises that we see in the world today, because this idea that we're just chemical machines in competition with other chemical machines for survival leads to a mentality where if you're able to manipulate the system to your own advantage, you'll do so even at the cost of others. So I think that's why we have the financial crisis in the world, because there are people who are placed in such positions where they can exploit the system to their own benefit and channel wealth from the pockets of the population in general into, you know, these huge financial and banking establishments and corporations. And if we can see, it's a very shaky situation. That's clear. And I think the root of it is this mistaken sense of identity that I think needs to be corrected by a new understanding of human origins, which, you know, I'm trying to do my part, you know, to communicate. So I can see that, you know, when I first started this work, I was thinking, well, it's like a purely scientific question, but I can see now that it's not a purely scientific question. It's a root question that affects everything else we do. You know, we need a different sense of identity. I think we need a sense of identity that includes the spiritual component of what a human being is. We're something more than robot chemical machines. That's very important for us to understand, I believe.
Right. Now, in one of your chapters, you talk about Rex skeleton. Tell me about this discovery. Why is that important?
Well, this is a discovery that was made in 1913, or at least it was published in 1913, by a German scientist named Hans Reck. And he made this discovery at a place called Ulduvai Gorge. And Ulduvai Gorge later became famous because the Leakey family made so many discoveries of fossil ape men there that have established the current theory of human origins, namely that human beings like us first came into existence only about 100,000 years ago, and before that there were just various kinds of ape men, and before that just various kinds of primitive apes and monkeys. But I thought it was interesting that at this place, Ulduvai Gorge, other scientists had discovered evidence that human beings like us were coexisting along with these ape men. We didn't evolve from them. We were simply coexisting with them in these very ancient times. So this German scientist, Hans Reck, he was doing some excavations at Ulduvai Gorge in 1913, and he found an anatomically modern human skeleton in layers of solid rock over 1 million years old, about 1.2 million years old, at a time when most scientists today think there were no human beings like us around because we hadn't evolved yet. So it's one of these very important discoveries that has been subjected to this knowledge filtering process. It's just completely excluded. As a matter of fact, there were some deliberate attempts to discredit the discovery. In the 1960s, there was a German scientist whose name was Rainer Proch. And he said, well, he had done some radiocarbon studies on a bone that was allegedly a small fragment of bone that was allegedly a part of this wrecked skeleton. And he got an age of about 10,000 years or so for for this fragment of bone. Well, there are two problems with that. Later, you know, it turned out that this scientist had faked dozens of radiocarbon dates in his career, and he was actually tried by an academic court in his university and removed from his position. And it's really not even clear that the fragment of bone that he dated was actually from Rex's skeleton. So I found this case to be very interesting because, first of all, it's documented evidence that contradicts the current theories of human origins. It's evidence of a human skeleton, anatomically modern human skeleton, dating back over 1 million years. And I thought it was also interesting to document the attempts by scientists to discredit this discovery by cheating, in a sense, faking radiocarbon dates to discredit the discovery like this. So it's if this just happened maybe once or twice, you could say, oh, well, all right, it's bad that this happened, but it was an isolated case. You know, the scientist was dismissed from his post for unfairly trying to discredit it with radiocarbon dates. But that's not the actual fact. There are actually hundreds of cases like this, enough to fill up a 900-page book. And it's just one more piece of evidence that contradicts the current theories of human origins.
Well, exactly. Now, tell us a little bit about the latest with Lucy. What's going on there?
Well, the latest with Lucy is Lucy's baby. You know, they, in recent years, they found the remains of a child ape man. And you know, whenever scientists find these so-called missing links, they try to humanize them and popularize them by giving them some name that people can identify with, like the original Lucy. The original Lucy was not Lucy Ricardo, you know. it was the bones of some ape man, you know, that they found in Ethiopia in layers of rock about 3.5 million years old or so. And this creature was about 3.5 feet tall with some very ape-like features indicating it was swung around in trees. For example, its shoulder joints were pointing upward, indicating that it spent a lot of time hanging from branches, which is not the image that the scientists would like to give of a so-called human ancestor. So they called this ape man Lucy. And then you think, oh, Lucy, a human, like my sister, my mother, my grandmother, or something like that. And so it was the same thing with the bones of this little baby ape man, again, very, very ape-like, that scientists found a few years ago, to draw attention to it and humanize it. They called it Lucy's baby. But you know, the fact is that these Lucy and Lucy's baby, they're not my ancestor. I don't see them like that. They're presented as human ancestors that are our forefathers, foremothers. And so I don't accept that because there's evidence from all over the world that humans like us were existing at the same time as these so-called ancestors.
Isn't that amazing too, Michael?
Yeah, it is. There's a concerted attempt to really brainwash people into believing that their ancestors were apes and monkeys. You go into any big museum of natural history, you'll see this little display where, they have a little ape or monkey, and then it gets a little bit bigger, and then the next figure, it's sort of half human, half ape, and then gradually it turns into a human being like us. And these exhibits are there in museums specifically to influence young children, 5 or 6 years old, because, parents who care about their children, and don't want them to just sit, at home and watch cartoons on TV all day, Saturday and Sunday, will try to give their children some culture. And one thing that they do, parents do, to give their children a little bit of cultural experience, is take them to a museum. And if you go to any big museum of natural history in a city like Los Angeles or Chicago or New York or London or Moscow or whatever, if you go there on a weekend, you'll see that most of the people there are families with children.
All right,
So,
let's get some more, Michael, when we come back. Plus, it's time for phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM.